It's very, very gratifying to see so many colleagues and friends here this evening, especially since it's the end of teaching, where they should be out partying, but they came to listen to a talk called The Rested Motion of Future Morning. It's not a particularly joyful thing, but the subtitle, I must explain, might change people's minds about it. It's called My Life as a Troubled Maker. Well, 1991 was not a very good year for me. I'd written two novels in 8 years and was staring down the barrel of failure. I was living in a small cabin in the Blue Mountains in Sydney with the curtains drawn because my three unruly dogs insisted on bringing me gifts of the neighbor's chickens. And I was reading Samuel Beckett's trilogy, Malloy, Malone Dies, The Unnameable, and I still have that copy with me today. Most of the pages have fallen out with rereading. Beckett said when he finished writing the last line of a book, he went to bed for 4 months. I just completed a novel and I didn't know it was any good. It was called Double Wolf. And I didn't feel any sense of triumph, though I thought 4 months in bed was taking my depression a little bit too far. Nobody was going to understand my novel. I went to bed and read Beckett. The first line in Malone Dies goes like this: I shall soon be quite dead, at last, in spite of all. And this is what I wrote in my diary on Thursday, 29th of August, 1991. I shall spite all, or soon be quite dead. Patrick White said Sidney Nolan had it in him to overcome despair. I've got to have it too. The writing came in a rush, now it's gone. Nobody will ever get it in Australia. Nobody ever does. They want national stories, but I have an anarchic soul. Nothing inspires me more than difficulty and suffering, fear and loathing. Without them, a writer is dead. Without spleen, you cannot overcome despair. I shall spite all or soon be quite dead. Unquote. Well, as a writer in Australia, I've always been conscious of the mark of lineage. My influences have always been from elsewhere, but my experiences are Australian. I don't mean that in a nationalistic sense, because I'm very much an anti-nationalist. My work was once described as having no precedence in Australia. Originally, I took this as praise, but soon realized this was meant as the opposite. I've been described as a hybrid writer, a fusion fictionist, a multi-ethnic mélange. And since authenticity was everything, I had always found refuge in impersonation. And this false life, which had obviously turned me into a writer, allowed me to entertain multiple cultural perspectives. It gave me an alternative in a country where literary identity was premised upon birthright, land, and landscape, the presumed poetic ownership which whitewashed the lineage of violent appropriation and the penal origins of white settlement. Imposture, therefore, may have granted me an empathy with besieged mentalities. For besieged mentalities exaggerate wildly. Exaggeration, Rabelais is one example, enables a novelist to force the suspension of moral judgment. As Milan Kundera wrote, suspending moral judgment is not the immorality of the novel, it is its morality. In the light of the current scandal being reported about Kundera, it is even more important to understand the function of reading novels. They reveal more than their fiction. They create an environment in which we can understand the truths of others. Without understanding and awareness, there is only disapproval and censorship. So impersonation for me coerced a reinvention of the self, forced open new perspectives, but it also played a prophylactic part, warding off despondency. This double life permitted the practice of a dialectic, a troubled identity. And a troubled identity may be the best way of resolving conflict in the modern world. In staging opposite positions under one roof in a state of melancholic immersion, it can turn passive depression into productive critique. So while I see myself as an Australian novelist with a small a, I do not feel I represent the linear inheritance of national feeling, particularly of land and landscape, blood and soil, propriety and tradition. What I can do is to worry the future into possibility. There is little doubt that I have become a writer of contradiction. On the one hand, I stage a condition which doubts its own authenticity. Consequently, many of my protagonists are hybrids of one sort or another. On the other, I'm critiquing righteousness, which is an artifice that masks the barbarities of civilization. And this ambiguous position is not only troublesomely illogical, but it's also threatening. It may explode into hyperbole or drown in allegory. This is the classic position of hybridity. It is above all a lexical hybridity, both acerbic and melancholic, hyperbolic and self-ironic, inside and outside the laws of grammar and of society. And I can think of no one better to express this hyperbolic state than the Austrian writer Thomas Bernhard. In his novel Extinction, he writes that, and I quote, "I've always found gratification in my fanatical faith in exaggeration. On occasion, I transform this fanatical faith in exaggeration into an art when it offers the only way out of my mental misery, my spiritual malaise. I've cultivated the art of exaggeration to such a pitch that I can call myself the greatest exponent of the art that I know of. I know of none greater. No one has carried the art of exaggeration to such extremes. And if I was suddenly asked to say what I really was, secretly, I'd have to say that I was the greatest artist I knew in the field of exaggeration. The art of exaggeration is the art of tiding oneself over existence, of making one's existence endurable, even possible." Unquote. And it is this hyperbolic mode that has enabled Bernhard to scathingly describe Austrian society in these terms, again in the voice of a narrator. "Genius and Austria do not go together," I said. "In Austria, one has to be mediocre in order to be listened to and taken seriously. One has to be a person of incompetence and of provincial mendacity, a person with an absolute small country mentality. A genius or even an exceptional mind is sooner or later finished off here in a humiliating manner," unquote. Even though this occurs inside a novel, it would be difficult to imagine any Australian writer writing this kind of splenetic attack on his or her own country other than Patrick White. It would be interesting to ask how a national literature recycles allegiances, how melancholy and spleen might offset this desperate patriotism to allow a vibrant criticality. And when I first began writing, I thought melancholic exaggeration was my own secret practice. But then I read Kierkegaard. In his book, The Point of View for My Work as an Author, he wrote, "From a child, I was under the sway of a prodigious melancholy, the depth of which finds its only adequate measure in the equally prodigious dexterity I possessed of hiding it under an apparent gaiety and joie de vivre. So far back as I can barely remember, my own joy was that nobody could discover how unhappy I felt," unquote. I think it's quite obvious that Kierkegaard's melancholy was an inwardness which concealed its truthfulness through dissimulation. By trying to deceive himself through jokes and impersonations, he was an inveterate pseudonymous pamphleteer, for example, he found solitude in his sadness, a state that was continually challenged by the excitement of literary experimentation. Since melancholy could never be represented because it's an irrational disposition, I think it's possible to say that this kind of sadness can be creative if you know you're fooling yourself into some kind of aesthetic posture which inscribes a truth. There is a normative element in this, and I don't think I'm stretching a point by saying that the solitude of creative sadness organizes a community of feeling which knows how to read between the lines and is sympathetic to what I call the reading posture. Without being confessive, a writer adopts a voice. Without seeking self-reference, a reader puts on a mask of curiosity. All this masking is a form of posturing, but it is also a civic disposition, a hermeneutic mode of relating to the world which offers the reader a liberation from quotidian and instrumental reason. The erection of disbelief, of judgment, of the righteousness of authenticity, all of this blurs art and life and neglects playfulness. The recognition of play, of humor, the awareness of another's awareness, the understanding of breadth and the astonishment of liberation, these are essential in reading. And I think every writer has to build this kind of community of awareness. And for a hybrid writer, I mean that in more ways than one, for a writer who's vehemently against the imprisonment of genre, which sometimes can provide a crutch for the lack of awareness, this constituency is invaluable. It varies between countries, and sometimes it varies between cities in the same country. In a civil society, the social world should be constitutive of the self. How we feel about ourselves is only the beginning of how we try to encounter others. By suspending suspicion and incredulity, there is a trade in illusion. Playfulness allows us to be complicit rather than confrontational. The proper aim of art, as Oscar Wilde said, was lying, the telling of beautiful, untrue things. As Wayne C. Booth had pointed out, Wilde is not disparaging ethics. His aim, Booth writes, is to create a better kind of person, the kind who will look at the world and at art in a superior way and conduct life accordingly. This trade in counterfeit prepares the ground for a possible unmasking of rhetorical sincerity, authenticity, and identity. In his book Liquid Love, Zygmunt Bauman comments upon the disappearance of the mask, a disintegration of impersonal ties and bonds leading to self-knowledge. By stripping off this layer of sophistication, commitment and value are both sacrificed to the temporary and to the sensational. Where once there was the art of civility, of wearing the mask, of impersonation for the sake of objective discursiveness without becoming excessively familiar, there now is the brevity of compulsive confession. Bauman writes that, quote, "The communities of sameness, predetermined but waiting to be revealed and filled with substance, are giving way to communities of occasion, expected to self-compose around events, idols, panics, or fashions. They last no longer than the emotions that keep them in the focus of attention. We belong to talking, not to what is talked about." Unquote. The contemporary social condition is not made up of a semi-permanent community of understanding, but it seeks brief, seemingly authentic encounters. It requires a confidence deposit, an identity branding, and then it moves on to the next situation. In other words, if I read Bauman correctly, there are no more civil and complex postures, but there is a great production of democratic chatter. And according to Susan Sontag, what passes for culture at the moment is effectively erasing the prophetic, the critical, the ironic, and the subversive. It doesn't allow for the insecurity or gloom from which the prophetic emerges. And it's important to keep in mind that the oracular and the visionary have always emerged from real rather than imagined insecurity. All the more important then to make a case for being troubled. The evolution of consciousness from Homeric externality to the modern subjective sensibility, for example, took place through a succession of wars, asylum seeking, and displacements. The modern sensibility arose out of being troubled. Visiting Kuala Lumpur several months ago, I had dinner with my Malay translator. Malaysia was in deep turmoil over its racial practices. People were demonstrating, and some in a violent fashion. The wounds of the past could not be healed and kept reopening. And it was necessary to do so in order to cauterize them through a recognition of them. During the course of this dinner, my translator gave his impressions of Australia. He had visited the country during the One Nation ascendancy and again during the latter stages of the Howard era. "Its white population," he said, "is unable to mourn, while its non-whites are unable to speak. They are like wounded animals." And I thought his description quite apt. The gesture of governments has always been to wipe off the muddy footprints on the white linoleum floor. But culture is, in effect, a muddy footprint in itself. The representation of Australian melancholy, which is obvious in its ritualistic celebrations of war sacrifice and battles with nature, distinguishes itself by erasing guilt and loss. Australian writing is layered with this inability to mourn others while glamorizing death as a concept. Social patriarchy lays an empty place at the head of the table for courage, but not for mourning. It is therefore not uncommon to find so much mainstream Australian literature settling for realism and ordinariness as factors of honesty and self-mastery. Whilst these can be sentimentalised, they cannot be intellectualised. So in Australian literature, there are countless mythologies of flawed men and women who transact mysteries with Indigenous peoples and with nature in order to find salvation through a recuperation of innocence. This enthusiasm for nativism is in effect a subconscious reappropriation of equality where there is none. The power of the primitive urges readers to admire characters who can thumb their noses at European sophistication, realism as a form of national legitimation. Simply to represent this readjustment is often considered to be holding the higher moral ground. It's why writers like myself fall into the too hard basket. I've often been described as difficult, but only because I do not share the generic taxonomy of Australianness in its identifiably sentimental tradition within its national mythologies. When one rewrites the past as a national story, one excuses the present. As Amartya Sen pointed out, it's a conceptual disarray, not just nasty intentions, which has contributed to the turmoil and barbarity we see around us. This conceptual disarray is a misunderstanding of history and a reduction of complexity. The reduction of history to politics has had a long tradition in many countries. Like the phrase, the clash of civilizations, the conceptual reduction of diverse identities to a national identity has contributed more to conflict than to understanding. Barbarism, it seems, is never at home, but it's always knocking at the door outside. Indeed, etymologically, barbarism derives from the word babble, the sound which foreigners make. And while many Australians may not think of themselves as particularly barbaric, they're also unaware that they live in one of the most regulated countries in the developed world. It makes itself foreign to others. I once tried to entice a very famous French sinologist to Australia. He was entirely put off by research funding bodies which demanded national benefits and national priorities. Indeed, during moments of its history, Australia has been an island of paranoia, entrenching itself as monolinguist, racist, and parochial. Over the last decade, for example, it has been institutionally punitive against non-whites, asylum seekers, Indigenous Australians, and down-at-heel immigrants. This may not sound too barbaric, but at the level of institutional control and bureaucratic babble, these instruments of cruelty in the name of identity and security have been more effective than cudgels. There was no further appeal for people wronged in this system. Take the case of Vivian Alvarez Solon. Seriously injured in a car accident, this Australian citizen was listed by the Queensland Police as a suspicious illegal immigrant. This woman, who held an Australian passport but wasn't able to produce it, was taken to a hospital, then held in a detention centre, and then deported to the Philippines. Confused, suffering mental illness, she was discovered by a priest 4 years later. She was living in filthy conditions in Manila. When her case was made known, the then Immigration Minister, Amanda Vanstone, commented, "There's a woman who was clearly in need of help and who, through, I think it's fair to say, no fault of her own, ended up in an immigration detention facility and clearly didn't have the capacity to explain to people who she was." Unquote. Well, fairness, it seems, is built into the notion of forgetting. But not for Vivian Alvarez Solon. She genuinely forgot her identity. For that, she was deported. And I think hybrid writers, and here I don't mean writers with a different skin, but writers who do not conform either generically or canonically, I think these non-national writers suffer the same suspicion about their authenticity. They've somehow misplaced their passports in the national mythology. They are suspect and illegal, lost in their labels and puzzling in their negativity. They trouble rather than entertain. They do not console. In a sophisticated literary culture, they would be the norm. But a whole range of perceptions once made available through reading within a humanistic education has been degraded by economic policies. In universities throughout Australia, deep thinkers and critics upon whom such writers had been relying have been turned into marketeers and petty bureaucrats. BookScan, the statistical website monitoring book sales, has become the measurement of culture. Such corporatizations of the imagination stipulate that thinking about oneself should be neither gloomy nor rhetorical, just quantitative. They declare that writers have never had it so good. This enforced cheerfulness has always been historically driven. The gloom thesis in Australian cultural critique holds the view that melancholics belong to an elite, that they retard material national progress. Melancholics, so this thesis goes, dwell in the luxury of complaint, living a life equivalent to aristocratic boredom. This position, which is both radical nationalist and conservatively bourgeois, devalues gloom, since gloom threatens national solidarity and is non-productive. Critique of nationalism, therefore, has been corralled into complaint. German social critic Wolf Lepenies points out in his book Melancholy and Society that while gloom carries an elitist claim, it's also a cultural critique which makes a claim for subtlety and turns against itself in a constant dialectic. As Lepenies notes, the elitist claim and the pathos of the special are combined with retrospection and with a dignity that draws its glory from dedication and sacrifice. The pathos of the special is why writers are writers. It's special because the struggle is not rewarded, at least in an artistic sense. The gesture is extravagant and its vulnerability is deep. If writers were sincere and authentic, they would have no other selves and would risk falling into stridency, sentimentality, or esotericism. But good writers are always characters in progress, a field of selves which can be drawn on for social reflection. This loss of a singular identity and along with it authorial reliability is a gain for others. But the residue for the writer is melancholia. Melancholy finds a space in which to suffer. It's dignified because it cannot be displayed. To enjoy any kind of display as a writer would be to risk the depreciation of one's writing, to lose its force. Baudelaire, for example, would not be Baudelaire if he had the same laurels bestowed upon him as they were bestowed upon Victor Hugo. The black bile which rages against acceptance is the result of a wound. A wound, when examined self-reflectively, is self-inflicted. It cannot call for pity or special pleading. As Edward Said wrote, learned protest only works if the exile refuses to sit on the sidelines nursing a wound. There are things to be learned. He or she must cultivate a scrupulous, not indulgent, or sulky subjectivity. A wound is not revenge or a working through. It's not about stoicism or endurance. It's not about the seniority of suffering or the triumphs of fame. As Lepenies notes, this wound that is melancholia stands against Enlightenment optimism, forfeiting the Enlightenment impulse to improve the world. Since this wound can never honour its suffering, its disposition is inertia. But it has value in generating rebellion and critique by menacing purity, canons, and happiness, all of which are forms of forgetting. The wound is the knot in the handkerchief, mindful of the illogic of the outside world, a memorial ligature tied to vision. Well, you know the ancient Greek story. Philoctetes had a bow that would never miss its mark when firing an arrow, but he also had a wound that would never heal. I think this is the condition of the melancholic hybrid writer. It's what Jacqueline Rose called a broken identity. The way, for instance, that Freud distanced himself from his own Jewishness in order to universalize it was to enact a broken identity in pursuit of a vision. And this was a long way from identity politics, light years from personal empowerment. As Rose said, you read a writer not for what they failed to see, not for the ideological blind spots of their writing, which is too easy, too programmatic in the literary academy of recent years, but for the as yet unlived, still shaping history which their vision partially, tentatively foresees and provokes. The task of such a reading is to dramatize the latencies in a prior figure or form that suddenly illuminate the present. Unquote. Well, I would like to suggest that this is what the hybrid has to offer, the time of reflection which provokes vision out of the trauma of being torn. Without losing sight of the dual propensities of melancholy for paralysis and for productive creativity, the hybrid's mourning for a loss of authenticity originally encourages the subject to hide inside his or her wound. From this, creativity is coerced. It was Abraham and Torek who first made the distinction between incorporation and introjection. Incorporation is where psychic functioning responds to trauma by substituting blockage, stasis, and paralysis in place of expression. Introjection is the process of accepting the wound, taking in loss, transforming it, and translating it into something new. In this creative melancholy, exhilaration and the abyss exist side by side. Well, in January of 1961, at the age of 11, I was sent by myself from Hong Kong to Australia to boarding school. My father had calculated that there was going to be a war between Russia and China. He saw himself as a bit of a political prophet. During holidays, I was farmed out to different families. My father had lost his job, and there was no money for me to return to Hong Kong. I was invited by a friend to stay in Gosford on the central coast of New South Wales. His mother was divorced from his father, and we were to spend alternate weeks in two different places. The first was with my friend's mother. She had remarried, and her husband was an ex-professional boxer, and they lived on the shores of a lake. She was very beautiful, and she enthralled me with her optimism and enthusiasm for my interest in writing books. She assured me she didn't read much, but would definitely buy everything I would publish. They had a large house which was being renovated. Life there was exciting and adventurous, and each day we fished and cooked what we caught, blue swimmer crabs and silver brim. And then it was our turn to stay with my friend's father. This tiny, depressed man lived in a returned serviceman's cottage, no larger than a cow shed at the foot of a hill. He didn't speak much, but he made delicious egg and lettuce sandwiches, and we would sit on the top of the hill, licking the mayonnaise from our fingers. Life there was very quiet. And one day he put us in his small Ford Prefect and drove us to a poet's house. We thought we would meet this poet, but it turned out he was dead, and the house wasn't very interesting. On the way back, my friend's father bought some beer, and then as the empty bottles clinked on the floor of the back seat between our feet, he recited one of the poems written by this dead poet. It was called Bellbirds, and some lines from it go like this. Often I sit looking back to a childhood mixed with the sights and the sounds of the wild wood, longing for power and the sweetness to fashion, lyrics with beats like the heartbeats of passion, songs interwoven of lights and of laughters, borrowed from bellbirds in far forest rafters, so I might keep in the city and alleys the beauty and strength of the deep mountain valleys, charming to slumber the pain of my losses with glimpses of creeks and a vision of mosses. For a brief moment, we were afloat in a different medium, flying in a different realm, all the way back to the small, gloomy house. The schoolroom had never been like this, spontaneous, passionate, and sad at the same time. My friend's father committed suicide 2 years later. I remember every detail of his house and his Ford Prefect. I remember that the bellbirds in the valley made a sound like clinking bottles. I've forgotten what my friend's mother looked like, but it was this sojourn which incited my first literary attempt, because the land was not at all the way Henry Kendall depicted it. The grey bush was not soft, but was as dense as any Southeast Asian variety. The road leading to the hills and valleys contained an absence which gave solitude a harshness unreconciled with the poet's fine sensibility. All that was needed was a swathe of suburban housing estates, which I'm sure have now sprung up, treeless and dusty. My friend's father was of Aboriginal descent, and I didn't know that at the time. It was only at his funeral that I understood the hidden affiliations which could not be spoken of in the 1960s in Australia. My vision of writing was formed not from romanticism of the bush, but from despondency and a yearning for a place elsewhere. It was influenced by two places, and I dwelt in neither. This homelessness was not a mourning for the past or a yearning for utopia, but a future melancholic design. As Kendall says, a safekeeping, not so much of beauty, but of pain, that which had not been obviously caused, but which recurred as self-infliction. Now, as long as this remains, literature will remain. For in my mind, literature is the linguistic recuperation of a suffering sensibility situated in the interstices of two different worlds, one which is real and one which is impossible. While the past cannot be changed and mourning cannot be accomplished, because in Australia, melancholy is continuously being warded off as weakness, that is, there is no conceptual construction of the lost thing. One should consider the possibilities and rewards of a future mourning. Future mourning means being equipped with vision, just as doomsaying has always been an important part of every culture. In 1907, Otto Gross married the idea of neurotic negativism with Freud's idea of unconscious repression. What Gross advocated was that writers throughout the ages had always been doing, telling stories with a good deal of negative content in order to release repressions wrought by the law of the father. Gross, incidentally, was decreed to be morally insane by his own father, a professor of criminal law, and was placed in a psychiatric institution. Upon his release, he befriended a writer by the name of Franz Kafka, and the two planned on putting out a journal entitled Pages on Combating the Will to Power. Combating paternal authority was and still is extremely necessary, particularly in Austrian society. Ridding oneself of repression allows the individual to connect with a wider cast of internal characters. These other selves destabilize authority by decrying authenticity and generating vision through apocalypse. As Maurice Blanchot noted, this farewell given ahead of time delivers a boundless insecurity. It's the insecurity of being which provides poetry, for example, with its Orphic or oracular qualities. A broken or troubled identity can be productive of vision, providing you have the ability to fool yourself into blindness first. You just don't know what you're going to foresee until you write it. Too much self-consciousness and the game is up. Too much manipulation and the authentic authoritarian self returns to put an end to your writing day. Well, I've always had the ability to fool myself. As a child, I became short-sighted quite suddenly. It was the result of an illness combined with reading too much in bed. I used to invent things that others couldn't see. Giant water buffalo grazing among skyscrapers in the hills above Hong Kong. A bejeweled Rolex watch projected onto the night sky. Gleaming angels arriving at dawn for Christmas. These diversions transformed my quotidian experience of depression, turning it from inexpressibility to invention and intervention. And I think I learned early on that invention was intervention. You changed yourself and others by thinking differently. Not in the realms of fantasy, but always straying closer and closer to reality, always near to possibility. The thing was that some of my fanciful sightings were quite accurate. An eccentric Hong Kong billionaire did scoop out terraces on the hillside next to his villa and imported water buffalo. One of the jewels in the Rolex watch turned out to be a Russian Sputnik traversing the night sky. A large stone angel was lowered by a crane at midnight onto the top of a church near my house some 5 months after I had first visualized it. Even my parents were impressed. My friends queued up to have their fortunes told. Now, I'm not claiming that this superior vision was the result of a blurring between the figurative and the real. It was true that I read too much and that I had an overactive imagination. But it was also true that in Hong Kong in the 1950s, the crisis over the Straits of Formosa led to violent political riots, resulting in a heavy-handed British response. The real was often surreal. It was not unusual for me to see bloated bodies floating in the harbour. Buffalo and angels were therefore essential in the assuagement of such trauma. It was the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard, again, who said that the imagination will have visions if it is educated through reveries before being educated by experiences, if experience follows as affirmation of its reveries. In my case, extreme short-sightedness challenged the imagination to store up alternative signs of the real, a process which ultimately produced a kind of parallel universe. But all of this blind talent for speculation and allegory came at the expense of a terrible sadness. Even today, I cannot believe that there can be happy writers. Happy writers are those who've lost the truth of their suffering. And it's through disturbance that the future can be glimpsed. The willingness to take on human despondency is essentially the social role of art, as well as its insubordination. It says no. It refuses happy endings. Its catharsis is for others. Slavoj Žižek wrote in a recent article that the melancholic's refusal to accomplish the work of mourning takes the form of its very opposite, a faked spectacle of the excessive, superfluous mourning for an object even before this object is lost. I hasten to point out the fakery. Writers who do not repeat canonical narratives need to be excessive to undermine assumptions. They are in the business of staging and anticipating apocalyptic scenarios wherein they mourn for something that is not yet lost. This was always their duty, to test the waters, to place an ear on the ground, not to distance themselves from society, but to experience desolation through impersonation and to risk perdition for prevision. This disappointment in never achieving perfection, this perpetual melancholic encryption of the open secret of failure, is actually the beginning of philosophy. Surely, every enlightened society must accommodate some form of exaggerated chafing. The unfulfilled potential of the past, the disappointment in the future, these are essential in the analysis of contemporary cultural symptoms in order to map the corruption or slippage of a country's symbolic values. The blandness of American happiness, as Eric Wilson pointed out recently, poses a far greater danger to its cultural life than any negativity, since it destroys creative melancholy. It is interesting for me to watch Barack Obama employ his hybrid creativity by shifting between cultures, between history, superstition, and vision. As a writer, this is also my lamentational cycle. Productive sadness depends on waste. It depends on time. It depends on wasting time for quality thinking. The desired object, that is the great novel, the perfect poem, is no longer wanted by the writer, even if obtained. So there is a constant provisioning of the desire for art. This storehouse of desire is virtual and essential for valuing unattainable perfection. It cannot provide happiness. But the gain in all of this is that of previsioning. One sees the end of a life or of a work through such striving. One sees the end of a novel or the pitfalls of a nation. And it's why writers whose real subject is themselves should also strive to be radars of a society, not only because they sublimate their own personal experiences, but because they are driven to make meaning out of historical catastrophe. Well, where did my melancholy come from? It's probably genetic, but nurture overrides nature. The trouble with migrants is that they're not entitled to criticize, and so their only recourse is to be counterfeit. This is where I find Kierkegaard so inspiring. He was not a migrant, but he knew how to dissimulate. "I am never entirely who I am," he writes in Fear and Trembling. "My deception is just as cunning as my depression is deep," he says, justifying why he should not go ahead with his marriage, which, like a novel, he already saw providing him with an unhappy ending. Difference and deep risk have always been characteristic of any real advance in culture and creativity. Kierkegaard was extraordinarily prescient about how modernity, and here we can substitute postmodernity, kills difference and passion, and difference arrives through passion. Kierkegaard knew how language, which leads us to the unknown, is destroyed by superficiality. In 1846, he wrote, "Eventually human speech will become just like the public, pure abstraction. There will no longer be anyone who speaks, but objective reflection will gradually deposit a kind of atmosphere, an abstract noise that will render human speech superfluous, just as machines make workers superfluous." Unquote. I think those of us familiar with corporate speak and the imitative theory and the jargon will tend to agree. I know that as a novelist, the novel possesses a history of its own, and that perhaps in some languages, in some cultures, that history is already coming to an end. And I wonder if V.S. Naipaul was right when he said the modern university had killed literature. Or was he assuming a posture which provoked debate? Milan Kundera has put it succinctly, but no less apocalyptically. He said, "A novelist talking about the art of the novel is not a professor giving a discourse from his podium." I hope I'm not doing that. "Imagine him rather as a painter welcoming you into his studio, where you are surrounded by his canvases staring at you from where they lean against the walls. He will talk about himself, but even more about other people, about novels of theirs that he loves and that have a secret presence in his own work. According to his criteria of values, he will again trace out for you the whole past of the novel's history, and in so doing will give you some sense of his own poetics of the novel, one that belongs to him alone, and that is therefore quite naturally different from that of other writers." So you will feel that you are moving in amazement down into history's hold, where the novel's future is being decided, is coming into being, taking shape amid quarrels and conflicts and confrontations. Quote. Well, I used to feel that in Australia, these quarrels and conflicts about literature and about the novel's future were what drove me to write. I issued the challenge of polyphony, or what I shall call polyphonia. I would like to call this art of the fugue, this assemblage of counterpoints and harmonious hybridities, this orchestra of voices, polyphonia, not polyphony. Not only multiple, but counterfeit. Not only multicultural, but linguistically invented. Not only polymorphous, but phony. We are threatened not by difference, but by sameness. Hybridity contains us. We are troubled when the monophonic leads us only to the forlornness of our entrenched identity. But we are enlivened when we know that the author knows that we are all trying it on. Is that not where the real novel began? Did not the real novel begin with exaggeration and with fakery, not only between the covers but outside as well, with Defoe, Rabelais, Cervantes, Sterne and Fielding? Not exactly writers of a singular national story, but digressors, diverters, funambulists and fakers who abandoned authenticity but not plausibility. And did not their prose come with a profound sadness even at the height of their comedy? Did not their prose come with a melancholy which emerged from speculation about the human condition, from reflections of possible worlds, far from realism and the cynical realism of the politics of the time? Why did they take such risks to endanger their own positions as respected citizens and comfortable burghers? Because they saw the future of the novel as a disruptive force. Less transparent to themselves, their imagination jeopardized their lives, raced ahead of respect, of authentication, to the point of ignoring the rites of passage which others had to go through. Alas, a modern novel carries so little weight now. I think political events in Australia in 1984 gave me pause to reflect on the bankruptcy of the notion of the rites of passage as an assimilative principle. In Australia, a rite of passage was no guarantee of equality. It was simply a kind of anti-intellectual levelling. By the end of 1984, there was a growing anti-Asian rhetoric and barricades were being drawn up in the media and elsewhere. The worst effect of that decade was the absence of the public intellectual voice in Australia. The great Australian good was in not trying to outthink the public. The public was always right. But it did not have a great sense of prevision. It irrationally predicted an Asian invasion, but as with most invasions, it played to populist sentiments and fears. Facts and ambiguities were always too difficult. Rites of passage in Australia meant more of the same. Nobody actually came through them. My first novel, Birds of Passage, was not an elegiac response to the suffering of Chinese gold miners in 19th century Australia, but a rebuttal of their marginality. Their presence on the Australian landscape was a glaring one, so much so that it had to be made invisible and unexpressed by the nation. They had no rights, and their passage was described as migratory, bird-like, in an attempt to wipe away their presence. But they left a powerful stain on the white cultural landscape. In 1984, a year after that novel was published, I felt that a whole community of feeling and understanding seemed to have suddenly disappeared overnight. Maybe George Orwell was right. In Australia, at least, Big Brother took the form of eliminating difference and of dumbing down culture. If the critical, subversive, and prophetic qualities of the novelist that Susan Sontag spoke about were to deepen or to oppose the common understandings of our fate, then we have to take more account of the use of language. Non-nationalist writers, non-myth-making writers, writers who write against the grain, are like subjected peoples living under colonial rule. How they use the language of oppression is important, how they mask and masquerade, relying on that interpretive community, that affiliative reception group, which would understand how borders are crossed in universal terms. Modernity challenges the writer to discard negative memories, to take a positive attitude towards progress. But writers of spleen caught in a contradiction, writers whom I call hybrid writers because of these contradictions, rely not only on the skills of perceptive literary critics, but on their own homelessness. Home is not a space, but a borderless time. There is no authentic position, given that representations of lived experience are always unstable. Resisting the comfort of the production of national mythologies, the comforts of home, they employ their melancholic memory, which is inert to begin with, and energize it by taking on shifting identities which grant creative movement. There is only, as Blanchot called it, a false certitude of being. What is produced is an acknowledgement of uncertainty and aesthetics of insecurity, along with linguistic creativity, major risk-taking, and speculation. The very things Kierkegaard expressed in 1848. Again, to quote Eric Wilson, "With no more melancholics, we would live in a world in which everyone simply accepted the status quo, in which everyone would simply be content with the given." But do we still have the skills of language and the time for such reflection, which I would call a non-revolutionary response to grievance? Do we still believe in non-consoling fictions, which are most efficiently expressed in a literary métissage, which is not a production of pastiche, but the result of a troubled making? I thought about all this last year on my way to my mother's funeral. I had already predicted her death, and a year before had sent out notices to friends and acquaintances saying I was in mourning and could not possibly make public appearances. I was writing my mother's death. Strangely for my friends, she died twice. For me, though, I was more prepared for the reality because she had already survived my writing. My previsioning had provisioned me. My mourning was no longer about me, about bad faith, because I was writing a literary death and not a literal one. My mother was already living in time beyond the brief space of her death. So as I drove, I heard the clear notes of bellbirds sounding like clinking bottles, and the scraping of cicadas sent coded messages through the electric air. I drove another 100 kilometres following the cat's eyes, those reflectors fastened onto the centre of the road. In ancient China, space and time were interwoven. Well before Einstein, the Chinese discovered that space and time were unified in the motion of matter. There was even a saying that time could be read in the eyes of a cat crossing a road. This hyperbole is filled with an elegant frivolity. In reflection, do we not see further in the dark? In seeing further, do we not return to ourselves in death? In Australia, cat's eyes reflect a long road back into a sad time. It's not a road studded by milestones, as John Howard said, those markers of plutocratic capitalism. But it's studded by all kinds of simultaneity of entry points, pathways which have long been grown over, occluded and masked, indigenous pathways. They haunt the mind because of a refusal to acknowledge their loss. Finding these entry points is not only the historian's undertaking, but the novelist's task. But we must never confuse history with fiction. History is a continuous construction of authority based on the real, but it is still constrained to representation, so this very authority is handicapped. Fiction calls down no credibility, no god of truth. It is self-sacrificial. But a novel can deliver conjecture, in other words, a non-consoling reading posture. Its negativity is a continual reminder that we are still human and mutable, that only when we mourn healthily, when we are able to speak our loss, when we use language thoughtfully, are we finally able to envisage a bright road into the future.